Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. This is Leon Gua, one of four hosts for this show. Today, we might be breaking our record for number of people in a single interview. Over the past few years, I have been working with a great team of people who, as graduate students from across the country, came up with a transdisciplinary research project that blends ecology, toxicology, social science, and urban planning to ask this question: how are the fishing practices of urban marine subsistence fishers acknowledged and protected by urban and environmental policy? Take a second and think about the last time that you were driving or walking along the coast. Do you remember seeing fishers out there with their lines cast over the side? They might have been on a beach, on a boat, on a pier, or even dangling a line from a highway. Often we think of these people as just being there for a good time or to take an hour for themselves, but a surprising number of those recreational fishers are taking their fish home to eat. And in some communities, it's actually quite a regular occurrence to be going out to catch fish to take home to feed yourself and your loved ones. We were really basically wondering what laws and local practices have been put into place which protect where these subsistence fishers are able to actually go and catch their meals, and how much consideration has there been for what types of fish those people are taking home to eat. There are already testing programs across the country which test a number of different fish species and how many contaminants they have in their tissues. However, it's not clear whether the practices of those subsistence fishers are taking into careful account when designing which species to test and in what size ranges. So we set out to learn a little bit more about this issue, which often has been overlooked, even though many people are eating the fish that they catch. This project was funded and supported by the National Socio-Environmental Synthesis Center, abbreviated SSINC, an amazing organization based in Maryland, which focuses on utilizing existing data sources to address critical global environmental issues. In successfully completing the project over the course of 2 years, based completely on pre-existing data sources, we found some concerning results which have implications for urban environmental justice. I wanted to invite my teammates to discuss first what we found, and second, share how in the world you do this kind of interdisciplinary research, especially as a graduate student. Without further ado, please enjoy our discussion, and I hope you learn a little about how you can integrate more human dimensions into your own research programs.
Welcome, everyone. I am so excited to have us all here in a room together to kind of celebrate the completion of our project and reflect on our experience. Can we start just by going around the room with a brief introduction of who you are, what disciplines you come from, where you were as a graduate student during the project, and if you've graduated, where are you now?
I'm Sarita, and I come from the field of public health and social sciences. I received my PhD in public health from the University of South Florida and a concurrent MA in applied anthropology in 2019. Right now, I'm working as an evaluator at the Social Research and Evaluation Center at Louisiana State University, and I'm really interested in health behaviors and access to health-related infrastructure, especially focused on water and sanitation.
And I'm Zach Kane. I finished my PhD at the University of Washington in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences in 2019. And now I'm working as an early career fellow for the Center for Ocean Solutions at Stanford University. And my work is focused on connecting aquatic foods to the healthy food system.
I'm Lauren Dracopoulos. So Zach, even though we've been working together for however many years, I didn't know that that's how you pronounce your last name.
That's all good.
I am a human geographer. I did my PhD in geography at the University of Washington. And as a human environment geographer, my focus is in oceans and fisheries governance. I'm currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of North Carolina in the geography department there. And my primary research is actually on the social dimensions of emerging technologies in oceans and fisheries.
Hi, my name is Dustin Robertson, and I'm an urban studies PhD student at Tulane University in the City, Culture, and Community program. My research really looks at the intersection of politics and planning and urban development. So really, who gets to make decisions about how the city is going to look in the future and how. I got into this project from that angle, and it also intersected with a personal interest I have in urban fishing. So it was really like a serendipitous thing for me.
Hi, I'm Meghna Marjati, and I'm a PhD candidate in organismic and evolutionary biology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I study how climate change influences fisheries, especially in relation to migration and reproductive patterns. And I'm really interested in how these changes in climate change and fisheries patterns will influence overall food security across the globe.
And I'll just round out our group. I'm Leon Gua. I introduced myself earlier, but as far as being part of this team, I also am a PhD candidate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst studying organismic and evolutionary biology. But the expertise I brought to the team was focusing on the ecology and physiology of fishes when it comes to environmental stressors, including contaminants. All right, so I think we're just going to dive right into this. I'm going to start with the discussion with Lauren, Meghna, and Sarita, as you were the three who first brainstormed this project and successfully got the funding from Succinct to conduct the research. What were the knowledge gaps or critical issues that you saw that needed to be addressed when you were thinking about this project early on?
Part of this project came from a recognition from another kind of volunteer project I was working on, looking at access to safe fish to consume in the Boston Harbor and realizing that fish consumption advisories, so those are directives that are given to anglers who are fishing recreationally or fishing for subsistence, didn't really match the locations where some urban anglers were fishing. So there were anglers fishing off the coast near the city who were referring to consumption advisories that were made based on fish that were caught on Cape Cod, which is much further away and not really subject to the same pollution. And so that had come up as like this gap between what people are eating and also the safety information that we had. Talking to Lauren about that, she had some understanding of subsistence fishers and access to angling survey data from NOAA, and we were able to think about how these things could pull together for different cities and look at the public health implications with Sarita's knowledge as well.
Yeah, I think that pretty much covers the story. I think the three of us were really finding different ways to bridge our various sectors of interest, and this really converged around an interesting topic where there were a lot of angles that you could look at, and my own interest there had to do with sort of urban health and thinking about whether potential risks from fish consumption were coming down on certain populations that it may already have been disadvantaged due to food insecurity or various socioeconomic indicators already. And so what were the kinds of compounded aspects of risk that may be sort of unexamined? So that was one aspect of it as well.
Yeah, and from my side, I had been for the Florida Fish and Game conducting dockside surveys, which were used for stock assessment purposes. But as a social scientist by training, thought, well, this is potentially really rich data source for understanding the human side of subsistence fishing, of recreational fishing. And it was really underutilized data source. So it was exciting to think about a new way to apply that information to different kinds of questions.
So can we be a little clearer about who we define as subsistence fishers for this particular project? And also just address why it was so important for this research to focus on urban coastal areas.
So that was one of the interesting dimensions of our project, was that there isn't a management category for the most part for subsistence fishers in the US, which means we don't actually have a lot of data. So we define subsistence fishers as people who catch their food for any reason other than pure recreation or commercial purposes. So if they're catching it, not necessarily to sell. So that could be a cultural practice for food for a lot of different reasons. But we had to sort of trouble the categories that were used for the survey, that data that we use, because the survey was conducted specifically to get information on, quote, recreational fishing. And so I think for the purposes of our work, people that kept the fish we classified as subsistence for the project.
It was really important. When we began looking at the literature out there, we noticed that almost all of it dealt with either rural areas and or indigenous communities in different parts of the country, such as Alaska or Wisconsin, places that are definitely important in their own right, but very different than the types of subsistence fishing practices we might see in a place like New Orleans or Tampa, Florida. So because there was this absence in the literature, we decided it was really important to focus on these contexts specifically.
And building on that, a lot of my work in my PhD focused on food systems in the developing world, where subsistence fisheries are much more represented in kind of the fish as food pathway, and not so much when you're thinking about fish for their nutritional value in developed country contexts. So that was kind of another knowledge gap that this project was able to fill. And it was really interesting for me, coming from more working in developing country contexts, to work on the project.
Maybe we can just delve in a little bit more into why subsistence fishing is so important in an urban area. Because I think people usually might think of cities or urban areas as maybe having access to a lot of grocery stores and a lot of food. And yet we're suggesting here that it's really important that we recognize subsistence fishing is occurring in city areas. And Sarita, you mentioned specifically some compounding vulnerabilities. And I wonder if you can just elaborate a little bit on what those vulnerabilities are and who is experiencing those vulnerabilities.
So one thing that we could think about is, from a health equity and environmental justice standpoint, we know that because of the design of cities over, you know, the last couple of decades, and because of just kind of various historical injustices, there are many groups of people that are often likely to be at lower access to fresh food, both through, yes, access to grocery stores and things like that, as well as access to other important amenities that are part of an urban life, such as good transportation, good housing, or being sited in a place that's sufficiently far away from a hazardous facility that is polluting the air, for example. And a lot of times those risks tend to come to bear more often on non-white people and those of low socioeconomic status. That is kind of where we were starting in terms of taking this health justice and environmental justice framework to think about compounded disadvantages to begin with. And when we looked into the research, we found that there are a lot of populations who either are often rely on subsistence fishing or are potentially not as likely to know about fish consumption advisories or be aware of them or consider them to be useful. And that many times that sort of overlap, and that some of those were, again, populations who were people of color, immigrants, especially limited English language proficiency and or of lower income or education level. So that is kind of where these two issues began to intersect as far as population. And so why that was of interest to us.
So what are the potential consequences of not addressing the knowledge gaps that were just mentioned by all of you?
One part of it is, again, these compounding risks of people who are already at risk for various health issues that Sarita just mentioned, going and catching fish and being subject to even more risks and health risks and access to food sources. But additionally, I think there's also a risk of people not being able to utilize this resource that exists for them. So if we don't have adequate data available about which fish are safe to eat, people who need an extra protein source and would like to go out and do some fishing may not know what to catch, how to catch it, you know, what's safe for their families, and then aren't able to utilize it. So I think there's two different risks of just how this food source can be utilized adequately.
At the same time, another risk that we were concerned about, particularly with regard to urban development and urban planning, was the access to places to fish. If fishing is sort of erased from our collective decision-making in processes such as urban planning, when the master plan gets written, if fishing is not included in it, then the development that happens over the next 10, 15 years, it's really going to be an absence there. And that really has implications for, yes, people's access to food, but also process. We mentioned other uses of phishing, cultural practices and things. So it was really important for us to think about in these processes where we're making decisions about the city, what practices and people are being included.
And related to that, if decision-making isn't made by city planners in New Orleans or in Tampa where we live, it also could lead to some issues with people potentially accessing less healthy waterways. So there you're getting a bit of an intersection between environmental health concerns and human health concerns that may be related to lack of acknowledgement in urban planning documents.
Right. So overall, it sounds like we wanted to know who the citizens fishers were in these urban areas, what kind of fish populations they were engaging in, and what kind of policy exists to protect their choices and what kind of fish they were eating, and what kind of access they actually have to places that fish. I am not a fisher, actually, but I have seen those signs that say, you are not allowed to fish on this pier, even though it looks like a wonderful pier for fishing. And I know, Dustin, since you've done quite a bit of fishing down there in Louisiana, you've come across all of those forbidden sites and whatnot on your treks out there.
Yeah, for sure. And that's one of the things that I noticed early on that I found really fascinating was comparing the sort of official sites where IMRIT data was being collected with the actual observed reality of where people fish in the cities. Sometimes they matched up and sometimes they didn't. You know, there are a couple of spots here in New Orleans where it is, in fact, prohibited, but perhaps not so strictly enforced. And some of those places are really important places where people are fishing quite a lot. So you happen to know that in reality, there's a lot of fish being caught, taken home, consumed, shared in the community from this spot, but there's no data being collected about those people at those places. So these sort of mismatches between where data is being collected and where people are really living and what they're really doing, that was one of the things that most interested me when I got into this project. And it was interesting to see how those dynamics unfolded throughout the project.
All right. So in the end, what was the overall research question that really drove the project moving forward?
I think our question was really, are urban subsistence fishers' practices reflected in, on the one hand, the way that we collect data about the fishery, the fish that we're testing to test for safety, and then on the other hand, in the built environment as manifested through these urban planning documents?
All right. So as you can tell, we talked about a lot of things in the previous answers to these questions because we've just got a lot going on in this project. But it's a really big question and a really important one. And there's a lot of different ways that it can be addressed. So one of the stipulations of the funding of our project was that we could only use existing data sources. And Dustin mentioned MRIP earlier.
I just want to briefly say that MRIP is a longstanding data collection program run by NOAA, but is created through a partnership with state and regional agencies. And essentially what they do is go out and survey anglers that they see along the coast who are catching fish and ask them information about their fishing trip, how many fish they've caught, what species. There's so many questions and it's a really rich database. And so something that we were able to take full advantage of. And you can always look up Marine Recreational Information Program or MRIP online to learn more information about it. So since we weren't able to collect any new data ourselves, we had to go out and find data sources like the MRIP to help actually address the questions that we had developed as a team.
We organized into three subgroups to focus on certain aspects of our project. So I think it'd be great if we could just go around and really kind of delve into the specific parts of those subgroups. Zach and Sarita, you focused on characterizing the socioeconomic status of urban marine subsistence fishers. Why was that important for the overall project and how did you actually do that?
It's an area that, as we mentioned previously in the podcast, that hasn't been that well studied. So we had to first kind of figure out, given existing data and the fact that we couldn't actually go out and interview people who are actively participating in fishing, other than Dustin, who lives there. We had to figure out some way to characterize who these people were that are associated with these recreational surveys. And we found that the easiest way to do that, given the fact that we could only use secondary data, was to look at the zip code that they were associated with. And from that zip code, you can tie it back to the socioeconomic characteristics associated with that zip code. And you can get some idea of the characteristics, social and economic, that people who live in households in those zip codes are actually represent. So it's a pretty high level look at who urban recreational or subsistence fishers are, but it's a good way to do it. And that's one thing that we were able to do for free. It could be replicated literally anywhere. at least in the States, of course. And it was critically important to the project because it allowed us to at least have some idea of what kinds of people were fishing more or less heavily at the sites that we were most interested in studying.
I think just to, add on to how we set that up. So we basically extracted the zip codes where people were found to be fishing based on the MRIP data. And we used that as an outcome while using census data as sort of independent variables. So we looked at a lot of different socioeconomic indicators, especially race, poverty, level of education, being on SNAP benefits or the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or otherwise known as food stamps. So we looked at these four or five different socioeconomic indicators, and we did basically a logistic regression where we're using that data to kind of predict the level of fishing, high, low, or medium fishing going on in those zip codes. We did find a lot of significant relationships, and it did suggest that there are some patterns that we're seeing where the level of fishing is not occurring randomly. So that somewhat did back up our hypothesis as far as there are some elements of potential disadvantage that are associated with more fishing in these cities. And then there were a couple of things that happened that sort of went against the grain, a little bit opposite from what we were expecting. And a lot of those things, for me, made it really valuable to have the other interdisciplinary aspects of the project, because it helped us make sense of each piece of what we were finding, partly because of the unique layout and sort of urban planning and environmental aspects of each city. What we did find is actually in both cities, so in New Orleans and Tampa, neighborhoods, or what we defined as neighborhoods, which were really zip codes, which had more racial minorities, people with no more than a high school education, and households with no vehicles, had significantly higher levels of subsistence fishing. And then we saw a couple of like divergences. For example, foreign-born people had some relationships in one area, but not the other. And being on SNAP benefits or food stamps, interestingly, was associated with more fishing in New Orleans, but negatively associated with fishing in Tampa. And so that kind of gets at what we were saying about these different place-based factors that were maybe coming into play in this picture in different ways.
Great. Thank you. So Dustin and Lauren, you did something completely different in that you reviewed city planning documents to see whether subsistence fishing was represented. Why was that important for the overall project, and how did you do that?
I'll maybe start with the how we did it. We collected a representative sample of urban planning documents, basically key documents that were from the municipal area for city plans or for other major projects for each of the areas that we were looking at. And so we took those and coded them in a qualitative data analysis software program. We used Atlas TI. We set up a typology to describe different kinds of phenomena. So how is nature, the environment, marine environment specifically talked about? How is it valued? What sorts of uses are described? And we coded through documents, used different parameters for each of those, and then coded the documents to see when these areas of interest were discussed and how they were discussed, to try to get an understanding of what the broader discourse or narrative was being told about the environment, about who should use the environment, how is that then planned for moving forward. So I think there I'll stop and let Dustin talk a little bit about why that's important.
We started from the assumption or understanding that planning documents are an imperfect but important representation of how the city is going to develop in the coming years. So as we know, of course, there's top-down processes by which the government makes a decision. Planning commission or planning council says, do X, Y, Z over here. And largely that's going to have a significant impact. Of course, there's bottom-up processes where people appropriate the city and do things in their own way and make use of it in ways that don't necessarily match up with the planning documents. So it's important to consider both of these, but we were really focused on the sort of the top-down. What is the policymakers, the movers and shakers in these places? What are they thinking and putting on paper? And Lauren did a great job of explaining the methodology that we used. I'll add here that, at least in my opinion, our work was really fun. It was a lot of reading. You know, a lot of it was just like really close reading of these 100-page documents. But we were looking at photographs. Who's in this picture? What are they doing? You know, what are they not doing? Who's not in this photo? Or if they give a little snapshot about fishing, how can we characterize that? Is it a really serious policy implication? Or as an anecdote, these kinds of things. And so in that way, our research was really fun. There was one photograph, I think, about a redevelopment plan for the Mississippi River, which got shared around our group. And we were all trying to figure out what one woman was holding in her hand, because we couldn't quite understand what was going on. So that was also an important part of our work, is to really understand these documents in quantitative terms, as in, do they mention fishing or not? one or zero, but also in these qualitative ways of like, what is really going on here? And that was something that I think that we brought to this project.
Surprisingly, even though we were looking at urban planning documents for two coastal cities where fishing is an abundant activity, we didn't see any reference to fishing in most of the documents except for a couple. And even then, it was really characterized as a purely recreational activity or purely commercial activity. And so this was despite seeing lots of recreational uses of waterfront, planning for recreational uses of waterfront. As Dustin had mentioned, we saw a really interesting photo for a big urban development project that was meant to be specifically for recreational use, and there was not a single person in that image fishing. So that was surprising. I think, too, we did see reference to other forms of food provisioning, so agricultural uses of the land. And so it's not food policy was completely absent, but specifically fish and fishing was absent as an aspect of the urban food system.
Meghna, we are the last two here. We focused on comparing subsistence fishing practices based on the MRIP survey and comparing them with mercury biomonitoring practices. Why was that important for the overall project, and how did we do that?
We were really interested in understanding whether or not the fish that urban subsistence fishers were eating was being tested properly and adequately. And so in order to do that, we quantified which fish were the most caught at the top 10 most visited fishing sites at each of our case study cities. We figured out which species were most likely to be reported as caught by recreational fishers. And we got that information from the MRIP, where we also got fishing visitation information. We then got some data from local departments of environmental protection and public health departments about the fish testing practices that have been conducted in those areas over the same study period as the fish catch data. And we tried to correlate what had been tested with what had been presumed eaten. And we were really interested in figuring out what had been tested within both 50 miles and 100 miles of the fishing locations. We ended up kind of also comparing the species that had been tested to the species that had been presumed eaten based on the recreational surveys. Overall, we found that a lot of the testing was not really in line with some of the testing requirements as far as timeliness or distance and location. So some of the available testing data was more than 20 years old and therefore may not have reflected the current conditions that may have been there for those fishes. And additionally, there were some species that were really popular among subsistence fishers, but that weren't being tested either because they weren't presumed as food fish by different representatives who were deciding on the testing, or they were not known to be caught. So those are the kind of things that we were looking at.
I think I was really shocked by how low of a percentage of the fish that were commonly being caught by subsistence fishers were actually being tested by the biomonitoring programs in that area. And just the idea that a fish being tested on the east coast of Florida would apply at all to a fish that's being caught in Tampa was really bizarre. And I think our data really showed that that's kind of what's being assumed in these biomonitoring programs. So it definitely seems like there were a lot of data gaps and ways that these programs could potentially use the MRIP data to learn about subsistence fisher practices and identify what size of fish they should be testing and what species of fish they should be testing. So I think there's a lot to be learned from our findings there.
Yeah, and I think we also noticed that there was only testing for methylmercury, and you had some like knowledge about other contaminants and ecotoxicology issues that were being missed.
Mercury is the only contaminant that really any program is annually surveying for, but there's an incredible number of other contaminants that any toxicologist can probably list off and incredibly depress you in talking about them. Mercury really tends to sit in the muscle of fish. And so I think that's often why people are more concerned about it, whereas there's a lot more contaminants which like to sit in the fat of fish, which sometimes people remove when they're taking the skins off and they only eat the fillets. But there are a lot of communities who consume fish who are not necessarily preparing fish in the way we think of as like Western food. They'll eat the fish whole, they'll put it all in a pot and eat it all together. And so I think there's a lot of potential contaminants that people are getting exposed to that they just don't even know about. And there's absolutely no testing on it unless someone complains about being worried about those contaminants. So yeah, our results really only apply for mercury, and there's a lot of unknowns out there.
This is Mary Levin Lauren from AFS headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. And did you know that AFS has a summer internship program for high school students who are interested in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences? Our goal of the Hutton Junior Fisheries Biology Program is to recruit students from underrepresented backgrounds in science careers and use this internship to introduce and inspire the students to continue on a path to become a fisheries professional. This paid internship is between 7 and 8 weeks long, and the students receive $3,000. Since the program's inception in 2001, the Hutton program has placed 717 high school students from the United States, Mexico, and Canada in hands-on, research-based internships with current fisheries professionals. We are always looking for interested mentors to recruit students in their local areas to apply to the program. You are the inspiration for the next generation of fisheries professionals. Now let's hear from some Hutton program alumni about their time participating in the program.
The Hutton program was a great experience for me. During my internship with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, I learned many things about the fisheries and environmental field. This program was a hands-on experience because I was able to perform field work in several areas around my state, was exposed to a professional environment, and worked with professionals. This is a very rewarding program.
Ready to get hooked on the Hutton program? AFS is recruiting fisheries professionals to serve as mentors, whether in freshwater, marine, or aquaculture settings. Donate financially or in kind as a volunteer today. Visit the Hutton website for additional information and to donate and help the future generation of fisheries professionals.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for sharing how they actually did these different pieces of the project. So thinking more integratively about these three subgroups together, what did you take away as the answer to your research question? Who are urban marine subsistence fishers? And were their fishing practices being protected and being represented in urban and environmental policy?
We saw that there were areas, at least, where, and now it's important to make a distinction here that we were looking at neighborhoods, right? We were not looking at the actual fishers themselves. So we can't say for certain exactly who the fishers themselves were, but we can say that the neighborhoods that had more racial minorities, people with no more than a high school education, areas that there were many households that had no vehicles, a lot of these neighborhoods did tend to have a higher level of overall subsistence fishing. And so we did see some support, at least for a sort of neighborhood effect of this type of practice. So that was one thing that we learned through our socioeconomic analysis.
I can share a little bit, building on what Lauren said earlier about our findings from the urban planning document analysis. We really found that fishing was definitely not prioritized in most cases. If anything, it could be mentioned as sort of a casual side anecdote or maybe some aesthetic function, but it wasn't really recognized as an important activity that was really happening in these places. Now, through our analysis, we were able to perhaps come up with some explanations in terms of why this may be. Some of it definitely goes with what Sarita was just sharing about who these populations are. If this is a population that's typically underserved and marginalized in urban context, we would expect that it's not going to be prioritized in urban planning. There may also be differences in the histories of these specific cities. So for instance, Hurricane Katrina had a tremendous impact on New Orleans, and all the planning that happened in the 5-10 years after Katrina was really influenced by this paradigm of resilience, building a resilient city. And we feel that perhaps some considerations like fishing may get glazed over in the interest of something like resilience. Whereas in a place like Tampa, which has also had its own share of environmental disasters, such as the BP oil spill, still we saw more of an orientation towards tourism. And we feel that maybe that led to a greater inclusion of fishing as this touristy economic activity that was important. So while we generally saw exclusion and omission, there may be some regional variation based on the specific historical context of the cities.
I think with the fishing itself, we found that there was definitely a disconnect between what folks were catching and what was being tested and how often it was being tested. And there was also kind of some confusion among the agencies themselves about how testing decisions were made and what led to the presence of testing. So Leon mentioned earlier that for certain contaminants, testing only occurred if a community made an effort to contact the department and get them to do the testing. And that kind of intervention isn't available to most communities. I think what we really found was this disconnect between testing, availability of testing, and who was getting the results that they could use properly to make decisions about their food consumption. We also noticed that some of the species being consumed were, quote, not traditionally consumed species or not consumed in Western cultures. And there could be some issues in considering those species as worth being tested just based on who's making decisions about this testing.
So it sounds like we have subsistence fishers who are coming from vulnerable communities. Their practices aren't always being protected, perhaps because there are other interests by urban planners for other reasons, whether it's to protect from hurricanes or to increase tourism profits. And finally, that when we can see what subsistence fishers are actually catching, it doesn't seem like it's matching perfectly well with what we're actually testing. And so there's a lot of mismatches here occurring across the different areas that we studied. And the people who potentially lose are, of course, the subsistence fishers. Let's get back to thinking about where our conversation started today and what the critical gaps in research on vulnerability of subsistence fishers is and what it means when we don't actually know about or address those vulnerabilities. What do you think, given our results, the potential consequences are for these urban marine subsistence fishers? And what do you think that that should kind of drive urban planners, fishery scientists, or other people to do to actually address those issues?
Speaking a little bit about some of the issues for the built environment. So if there's not space that's designated for an activity that people are going to practice for a variety of reasons that we've mentioned already, I mean, when the stakes are higher than just purely recreation and it's a cultural practice or it's a food practice that you become reliant on, then whether or not there's an official space that's designated for that, you're still going to engage in that practice. And so maybe the city is not planning for urban fishing or isn't aware of where urban fishing is happening, then they could take a site that people might have historically practiced fishing and destroy it. They could make it a site that could become a privatized site where people aren't allowed to be there legally. And so then suddenly you have people engaging in behavior that they have maybe always done or their families have always done. And now they run the risk of some sort of criminal offense or just being in a place that isn't safe for a variety of reasons, or just don't have access to the space at all. And so really breaking down those longstanding familial practices that are how people develop identities related to place. So I think that's one of the big concerns that we saw from the urban planning side.
Relatedly, and a lot of this kind of came together for especially the part that you and Meg and I were working on, Leon, is simply that there are subsistence fishers out there consuming fish of which the risk is sort of unknown because they're not necessarily being tested appropriately for the correct kind of toxicology risk assessments, either because species are not the species that people are actually fishing, or as Lauren pointed out as well, the location where these folks are fishing is not necessarily factoring in to the testing sites. It's that there are folks fishing things regularly that their own estimation of what the potential risk is not something that is known by state agencies. And then relatedly, I think there's kind of a broader risk where, as a public health researcher, I know that actually this tends to happen quite a lot, where there's expert opinion coming out telling people, hey, you know, do this. And nowhere has that become more clear than the pandemic right now, where experts are saying that, and then people are saying, well, no, I'm not going to do that because you don't really get where I'm coming from, or you don't really understand my life ways. But, you know, there's this distrust at times of expert knowledge. And I think that when people are fishing certain types of species that aren't necessarily the risk for them is not quite being known, then that could also potentially amplify either erroneous fish consumption advisories, or it may amplify distrust of fish consumption advisories, which is a concern in the long term as well. So those are some other risks that I want to point out.
And just to echo a little bit more on the point that Sarita was making, at least where I live in coastal California, we're definitely seeing a pretty major increase overall in the number of subsistence fishers, both on docks, harvesting shellfish in the intertidal. So when you couple just a lack of understanding of exactly where people are fishing with us potentially not actually analyzing either the correct fish or the correct length of fish or the correct toxin, that can create some pretty serious challenges from an environmental justice as well as a public health perspective.
think the point that both Zach and Serena made also about this distrust in science and in recommendations is worth considering additionally, because there has been research on subsistence fishers and their trust of fish consumption advisories that shows that there's already an existing level of distrust among some urban subsistence fishers of these advisories. And there's a lot of research that's been done to make those communications more acceptable and clearer for different groups. But if the data themselves that are making those advisories aren't good or aren't coming from the right place, then again, that distrust is just going to grow.
What would you recommend to people who are involved in the decision-making process for how they can actually adjust what they're doing to account for these mismatches or not make assumptions about how they believe people to be engaging with these resources?
Basically, the message is do a better job of including people. And this is something that is not new to planning. There's constantly a push for greater inclusivity. And some progress has been made, but there's still a lot to do. So, you know, our research is definitely one, recognizing the different diverse populations of the cities, New Orleans and Tampa. Populations are not monolithic. You have a lot of different groups that may have different practices. So recognizing that the planning should not just be for this single white male heteronormative figure around which a lot of planning is made, to consider the very diverse populations that live in these places. That's the first thing. The second one is to recognize diversity in practice. Earlier it was mentioned there are these assumptions that, well, in cities, everyone gets their food from a grocery store. Well, that's not exactly the case. And really taking a deeper look at just where people's food comes from and how they get it. So really considering these aspects instead of some other considerations, such as what do tourists want to do when they come to our cities, or what's going to make us the most profit? Really considering the people that live in these places, who they are and what they're doing.
Broadly, thinking about listening to the people and their constituencies and what they really need, either by reaching out directly to people who are fishing in urban areas and maybe talking to them about what they're fishing for and what they're doing, or maybe utilizing recreational fisheries data to better understand what's going on. So the recreational fisheries data that we used weren't meant for doing what we're doing. They're not meant for social science analysis at all. But I think if those surveys are already being done, they're a great opportunity to either add a few more questions or restructure in some way to learn about what people are fishing for and then try to reflect that in the research programs that are being constructed. I also think somehow thinking about how to communicate better both with different agencies about what is important to each agency as well as with urban planning departments might help with everything kind of coming together a little better.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And just the idea of incorporating more social science into fisheries programs, I think is really important. Not making assumptions that a fish is always going to be a bait fish and that nobody is ever going to eat a certain fish. Like I know we've talked about Atlantic croaker a couple of times because that was one that very commonly was getting caught and taken home, but no testing had been done on it, I think, in either of our focus case studies. So as you said, Magna, listening to the constituents and looking at what they're actually doing on the ground and utilizing existing data sources that will tell you that exact information. Sarita and Zach, do you want to add anything about how MRIP data or similar data sources can be used to just tell us more about subsistence fishing communities?
Just quickly, and also this builds a little bit on what Dustin was saying, is that in actually connecting zip codes to the areas where people are fishing, we have to realize that fishers are not just a monolithic group of people. It's an incredibly diverse set of people across different backgrounds. At least in New Orleans and Tampa, we saw that there tended to be higher engagement with neighborhoods or zip codes where there are higher percentages of racial minorities, as an example. But at the same time, that isn't always going to be the case everywhere you are. And I think it's really important for people who are in positions of managerial power to start actually thinking about breaking down the monolith of the fisher being a recreational fisher with every gadget possible going out and catching the biggest fish fish they possibly can, because recreational fishing in America is a lot more complex than that. And I think in connecting socioeconomic data a little bit more clearly with the surveys, that's something that we've been able to show. And I think it's also important that managers actually potentially, when they're managing recreational resources, start to actually use some of the census data. It just speaks to the power that census data can have across a wide variety of fields.
Zach made a really good point, which I also just want to quickly echo, which is we want to be very clear here that we hope that this will contribute to some knowledge about the dynamics of subsistence fishing along two important fishing cities in the Gulf Coast, where there is not as much of this type of research. But we also want to be clear that we don't imagine that any of these findings would be sort of nationally representative. And part of the lesson here is that so much about the cultural and the socioeconomic composition of each city, the nature that urban planning has played out, and also the specifics of contamination by locality is going to vary. And so some of it is not necessarily to say that these are the dynamics that we think you all are going to find everywhere, but to kind of use this as an important way to synthesize and integrate data in useful ways that can impact governance on a sort of local and regional level. So that is also kind of piggybacking on what everybody has said there, thinking about governance on that scale as well.
I think that's a really important point, Sarita. The idea that you can gain all of this information in this collaborative way, I think, is really useful and really important.
Well, I think that concludes our discussion of our research and our findings. And we're going to stop there for the first part of this episode. And please join us for part two, where our team discusses the experience of this transdisciplinary collaborative project. And we will also talk to Dr. Nicole Motzer, who is the Assistant Director for Interdisciplinary Science at SASINC. And she gives us a little bit more insight into the other fisheries projects which have been funded by SASINC, and give us some tools for how you can get started on your interdisciplinary collaborative fisheries research journey. So please join us for that, and we'll see you next time.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com, and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.